Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, by Ayn Rand. Continued, Disc 11. The employer uses the ones whom he employs. The salesman uses his customers. There is not much love or hate to be found in human relations of our day. There is rather a superficial friendliness and a more than superficial fairness, but behind that surface is distance and indifference. The alienation between man and man results in the loss of those general and social bonds which characterize medieval as well as most other pre-capitalist societies. Frome is claiming that there existed in pre-capitalist societies a mutual goodwill among men, an attitude of respect and benevolent solidarity, a regard for the value of the human person that vanished with the rise of a free market society. This is worse than false. The claim is absurd historically and disgraceful morally. It is notorious that in the Middle Ages, human relationships were characterized by mutual suspiciousness, hostility, and cruelty. Everyone regarded his neighbor as a potential threat, and nothing was held more cheaply than human life. Such invariably is the case in any society where men are ruled by brute force. In putting an end to slavery and serfdom, capitalism introduced a social benevolence that would have been impossible under earlier systems. Capitalism valued a man's life as it had never been valued before. Capitalism is the politico-economic expression of the principle that a man's life, freedom, and happiness are his by moral right. There is a passage in The Fountainhead that bears on this issue. Civilization is the progress toward a society of privacy. The savage's whole existence is public, ruled by the laws of his tribe. Civilization is the process of setting man free from men. Under capitalism, men are free to choose their social bonds, meaning to choose whom they will associate with. Men are not trapped within the prison of their family, tribe, caste, class, or neighborhood. They choose whom they will value, whom they will befriend, whom they will deal with, what kind of relationships they will enter. This implies and entails men's responsibility to form independent value judgments. It implies and entails also that a man must earn the social relationships he desires. But this clearly is anathema to Frome. Love, he has told us, is the only sane and satisfactory answer to the problem of human existence. But, he asserts, love and capitalism are inimical. The principle underlying capitalistic society and the principle of love are incompatible. The principle of capitalism, says Frome, is that of fairness ethics, of trade, of the exchange of values, without recourse to force or fraud. Individuals deal with one another only on the premise of mutual self-interest. They exchange only in those transactions from which they expect a profit, reward, or gain. It may even be said that the development of fairness ethics is the particular ethical contribution of capitalist society. But to approach love with any concern for one's self-interest is, he asserts, to negate the very essence of love. To love an individual is to feel care and responsibility for him. It is not to appraise his character or personality as a commodity from which one expects pleasure. To love ideally is to love unconditionally. It is to love a human being not for the fact of what he is, but for the fact that he is. It is to love without reference to values or standards or judgment. In essence, all human beings are identical. We are all part of one. We are one. This being so, it should not make any difference whom we love. It should not, in other words, make any difference whether the person we love is a being of stature or a total non-entity, a genius or a fool, a hero or a scoundrel. We are all part of one. Is it necessary to point out who stands to gain and who to lose by this view of love? The desire to be loved unconditionally, the desire to be loved with no concern for his objective personal worth, is one of man's deepest longings, Frome insists, whereas to be loved on the basis of merit, because one deserves it, invokes doubt and uncertainty, since merit has to be struggled for, and since such love can be withdrawn should the merit cease to exist. Furthermore, deserved love easily leaves a bitter feeling that one is not loved for oneself, that one is loved only because one pleases. It is typical of Frome that he should deliver what is in fact, though not in Frome's estimate, a deadly insult to human nature, without offering any justification for his charge. He assumes that all men by nature are so profoundly lacking in self-esteem that they crave a love which bears no relation to their actions, achievement, or character. A love not to be earned, but to be received only as a free gift. What does it mean to be loved for oneself? In reason, it can mean only to be loved for the values one has achieved in one's character and person. The highest compliment one can be paid by another human being is to be told, "Because of what you are essential to my happiness." But this is the love that, according to Frome, leaves one with a bitter feeling. It is the capitalistic culture, he declares, that inculcates such concepts as the deserved and the undeserved, the earned and the unearned, and thus poisons the growth of proper love. Proper love, Frome tells us, should be given solely out of the richness of the spirit of the giver, in demonstration of the giver's potency. Frome nowhere reveals the exact nature of this potency, of course. Love is an act of faith. Proper love should raise no questions about the virtue or character of its object. It should desire no joy from such virtue as the object might possess. For if it does, it is not proper love, it is only capitalistic selfishness. But Frome asks, how can one act within the framework of existing society and at the same time practice love? He does not declare that love is impossible under capitalism, merely that it is exceptionally difficult. Commenting in Who is Ayn Rand on Frome's theory of love, I wrote, "To love is to value. Love, properly, is the consequence and expression of admiration, the emotional price paid by one man for the joy he receives from the virtues of another." Atlas shrugged. "Love is not alms, but a moral tribute. If love did not imply admiration, if it did not imply an acknowledgement of moral qualities that the recipient of love possessed, what meaning or significance would love have? And why would Frome or anyone consider it desirable? Only one answer is possible, and it is not an attractive one. When love is divorced from values, then love becomes not a tribute, but a moral blank check, a promise that one will be forgiven anything, that one will not be abandoned, that one will be taken care of." This view of love is not, of course, peculiar to Frome. It is a central component of the mystic altruist tradition, and is as prevalent among psychologists, sociologists, and philosophers as it is among religionists. Perhaps the simplest and most eloquent answer to this view of love is one sentence of John Galt in Atlas Shrugged. "A morality that professes the belief that the values of the spirit are more precious than matter. A morality that teaches you to scorn a whore who gives her body indiscriminately to all men. This same morality demands that you surrender your soul to promiscuous love for all comers." To divorce love from values and value judgments is to confess one's longing for the unearned. The idealization of this longing as a proper moral goal is a constant theme running through Frome's writing. That the underlying motive is the desire to be taken care of, the desire to be spared the responsibility of independence, is revealed explicitly in Frome's socio-political solution to the problem of alienation. In order that man may be enabled to conquer his feeling of aloneness and alienation, to practice love and to achieve a full sense of personal identity, a new social system must be established, Frome declares. Private ownership of the means of production must be abolished. The profit motive must be forbidden. Industry must be decentralized. Society should be divided into self-governing industrial guilds. Factories should be owned and run by all those who work in them. Why, according to Frome's social philosophy, should a janitor in an industrial plant not have the same right to determine its management as the man who happened to create the plant? Does not the janitor's personality require as much self-expression as anyone else? Under capitalism, says Frome, men are overwhelmed by and are the pawns of a complex industrial machine whose omnipotent forces and laws are beyond their comprehension or control. Under the decentralized democratic system he proposes, which is some sort of blend of guild socialism and syndicalism, industrial establishments will be broken down into units whose function is within everyone's easy comprehension, with no alienating demands made on anyone's abstract capacity. Under this system, he explains, every person will be provided with his minimum subsistence whether the person wishes to work or not. This is necessary if man is to develop healthily and happily. However, to discourage parasitism, Fromm suggests that this support should not extend beyond 2 years. Who is to provide the support, whether they will be willing to do so, and what will happen if they are not willing, are questions Fromm does not discuss. So long as men are occupied with the problem of survival, Fromm feels, their spiritual concerns, the concerns that really matter, are almost inevitably neglected. How can the worker's personality not be impoverished if he must face daily the necessity of earning a livelihood? How can the businessman develop his creative potentialities if he is in bondage to his obsession with production? How can the artist preserve his soul's integrity if he is plagued with temptations by Hollywood and Madison Avenue? How can the consumer cultivate individual tastes and preferences if he is surrounded by the standardized commodities begotten by mass production? If one wishes to understand the relevance of epistemology to politics, one should observe what is gained for Fromm by that paradoxical logic of which he writes so approvingly. If, as it teaches, man can perceive reality only in contradictions, then Fromm does not have to be troubled by the conflict between his claim to be an advocate of reason and his enthusiasm for Eastern mysticism, nor does he have to be troubled by the conflict between his claim to be a defender of individualism and his advocacy of political collectivism. His disdain for the law of contradiction permits him to announce that true individualism is possible only in the collectivized community, that true freedom is possible only when production is taken out of the hands of private individuals and placed under the absolute control of the group, that men will cease to be objects of use by others only when they are willing to renounce personal profit and make social usefulness the goal of their lives. Fromm calls his proposed system humanistic communitarian socialism. Under it, he maintains man will achieve a new harmony with nature to replace the one he has lost. Man will enjoy the tranquility and self-fulfillment of the animals whose state Fromm finds so enviable. If, often, Fromm is more than a little disingenuous in the presentation of his views, he is nonetheless extremely explicit. This is what is unusual about him. Most writers of his persuasion twist themselves for pages and pages in order to obscure their advocacy of the ideas and contradictions which he announces openly. With rare exceptions, one will find comparable candor only among the existentialists and Zen Buddhists, many of whose premises Fromm shares. His explicitness notwithstanding, he is very representative culturally and should be recognized as such. The recurrent themes running through the literature on alienation, and through today's social commentary generally, are the themes which Fromm brings into naked focus. That reason is unnatural. That a non-contradictory, objective reality restricts one's individuality. That the necessity of choice is an awesome burden. That it is tragic not to be able to eat one's cake and have it too. That self-responsibility is frightening. That the achievement of personal identity is a social problem, that love is the omnipotent solution, and that the political implementation of this solution is socialism. The transparent absurdity, or the unintelligibility, of most discussions of alienation might tempt one to believe that the issue is entirely illusory, but this would be an error. Although the explanations offered for it are spurious, the problem of alienation is real. A great many men do recognize the painful emotional state which writers on alienation describe. A great many men do lack a sense of personal identity. A great many men do feel themselves to be strangers and afraid in a world they never made. But why? What is the problem of alienation? What is personal identity? Why should so many men experience the task of achieving it as a dreaded burden? And what is the significance of the attacks on capitalism in connection with this issue? These are the questions we must now proceed to answer. The problem of alienation and the problem of personal identity are inseparable. The man who lacks a firm sense of personal identity feels alienated. The man who feels alienated lacks a firm sense of personal identity. Pain is an organism's alarm signal, warning of danger. The particular species of pain, which is the feeling of alienation, announces to a man that he is existing in a psychological state improper to him, that his relationship to reality is wrong. No animal faces such questions as, what should I make of myself? What manner of life is proper to my nature? Such questions are possible only to a rational being, i.e. a being whose characteristic method of cognitive functioning, of apprehending reality, is conceptual, who is not only conscious but also self-conscious, and whose power of abstraction enables him to project many alternative courses of action. Further, such questions are possible only to a being whose cognitive faculty is exercised volitionally. Thinking is not automatic. A being who is self-directing and self-regulating in thought and action, and whose existence therefore entails a constant process of choice. As a living entity, man is born with specific needs and capacities. These constitute his species identity, so to speak, i.e., they constitute his human nature. How he exercises his capacities to satisfy his needs, i.e., how he deals with the facts of reality, how he chooses to function in thought and in action, constitutes his personal or individual identity. His sense of himself, his implicit concept or image of the kind of person he is, including his self-esteem or lack of it, is the cumulative product of the choices he makes. This is the meaning of Ayn Rand's statement that man is a being of self-made soul. A man's I, his ego, his deepest self, is his faculty of awareness, his capacity to think, to choose to think, to identify the facts of reality, to assume the responsibility of judging what is true or false, right or wrong, is man's basic form of self-assertiveness. It is his acceptance of his own nature as a rational being, his acceptance of the responsibility of intellectual independence, his commitment to the efficacy of his own mind. The essence of selflessness is the suspension of one's consciousness. When and to the extent that a man chooses to evade the effort and responsibility of thinking, of seeking knowledge, of passing judgment, his action is one of self-abdication. To relinquish thought is to relinquish one's ego, and to pronounce oneself unfit for existence, incompetent to deal with the facts of reality. To the extent that a man chooses to think, his premises and values are acquired firsthand, and they are not a mystery to him. He experiences himself as the active cause of his character, behavior, and goals. To the extent that a man attempts to live without thinking, he experiences himself as passive. His person and actions are the accidental products of forces he does not understand, of his range of the moment feelings and random environmental influences. When a man defaults on the responsibility of thought, he is left at the mercy of his involuntary subconscious reactions, and these will be at the mercy of the outside forces impinging upon him, at the mercy of whoever and whatever is around him. By his default, such a person turns himself into the social determinist's view of man, into an empty mold waiting to be filled, into a willless robot waiting to be taken over by any environment and any conditioners. A strong sense of personal identity is the product of two things: a policy of independent thinking, and as a consequence, the possession of an integrated set of values. Since it is his values that determine a man's emotions and goals and give direction and meaning to his life, a man experiences his values as an extension of himself, as an integral part of his identity. as crucial to that which makes him himself. Values in this context refers to fundamental and abstract values, not to concrete value judgments. For example, a man holding rationality as his abstract value may choose a friend who appears to embody this value. If subsequently he decides that he was mistaken in his judgment, that his friend is not rational, and that their relationship should be ended, this does not alter his personal identity. But if, instead, he decides that he no longer values rationality, his personal identity is altered. If a man holds contradictory values, these necessarily do violence to his sense of personal identity. They result in a splintered sense of self, a self broken into unintegratable fragments. To avoid this painful experience of a splintered identity, a man whose values are contradictory will commonly seek to escape knowledge of his contradictions by means of evasion, repression, rationalization, etc. Thus, to escape a problem created by a failure of thought, he suspends thinking. To escape a threat to his sense of personal identity, he suspends his ego. He suspends his self qua thinking, judging entity. Thus, he displaces his sense of self downward, so to speak, from his reason, which is the active, initiating element in man, to his emotions, which are the passive, reactive element. Moved by feelings whose source he does not understand, and by contradictions whose existence he does not acknowledge, he suffers a progressive sense of self-estrangement, of self-alienation. A man's emotions are the product of his premises and values, of the thinking he has done or has failed to do. But the man who is run by his emotions, attempting to make them a substitute for rational judgment, experiences them as alien forces. The paradox of his position is this: his emotions become his only source of personal identity, but his experience of identity becomes a being ruled by demons. It is important to observe that the experience of self-alienation and the feeling of being alienated from reality, from the world around one, proceed from the same cause, one's default on the responsibility of thinking. The suspension of proper cognitive contact with reality and the suspension of one's ego are a single act. A flight from reality is a flight from self. One of the consequences is a feeling of alienation from other men, the sense that one is not part of the human race, that one is, in effect, a freak. In betraying one's status as a human being, one makes oneself a metaphysical outcast. This is not altered by the knowledge that many other human beings have committed the same betrayal. One feels alone and cut off by the unreality of one's own existence, by one's desolate inner sense of spiritual impoverishment. The same failure of rationality and independence by which men rob themselves of personal identity leads them, most commonly, to the self-destructive policy of seeking a substitute for identity, or more precisely, seeking a second-hand identity through mindless conformity to the values of others. This is the psychological phenomenon which I have designated as social metaphysics. In my article, Rogue's Gallery, dealing with different types of social metaphysicians, I commented on the type most relevant to the present context, the conventional social metaphysician. This is the person who accepts the world and its prevailing values ready-made. His is not to reason why. What is true, what others say is true. What is right, what others believe is right. How should one live? As others live. This is the person whose sense of identity and personal worth is explicitly a function of his ability to satisfy the values, terms, and expectations of those omniscient and omnipresent others. In a culture such as the present one, with its disintegrating values, its intellectual chaos, its moral bankruptcy, where the familiar guideposts and rules are vanishing, where the authoritative mirrors reflecting reality are splintering into a thousand unintelligible subcults, where adjustment is becoming harder and harder, the conventional social metaphysician is the first to run to a psychiatrist crying that he has lost his identity because he no longer knows unequivocally what he is supposed to do and be. It would never occur to a person of self-esteem and independent judgment that one's identity is a thing to be gained from or determined by others. To a person untouched by self-doubt, the wails heard today about the anguish of modern man as he confronts the question, "Who am I?" are incomprehensible. But in the light of the above, the wailing becomes more intelligible. It is the cry of social metaphysicians who no longer know which authorities to obey, and who are moaning that it is someone's duty to herd them to a sense of self, that the system must provide them with self-esteem. This is the psychological root of the modern intellectual's mystique of the Middle Ages, of the dazed longing for that style of life, and of the massive evasion concerning the actual conditions of existence during that period. The Middle Ages represents the social metaphysician's unconfessed dream, a system in which his dread of independence and self-responsibility is proclaimed to be a virtue and is made a social imperative. When, in any age, a man attempts to evade the responsibility of intellectual independence and to derive his sense of identity from belonging, he pays a deadly price in terms of the sabotaging of his mental processes thereafter. The degree to which a man substitutes the judgment of others for his own, failing to look at reality directly, is the degree to which his mental processes are alienated from reality. He functions not by means of concepts, but by means of memorized cue words, i.e. learned sounds associated with certain contexts and situations, but lacking authentic cognitive content for their user. This is the unidentified, unrecognized phenomenon that prompts unthinking people today to grant validity to the charge that modern man lives too abstractly, too intellectually, and that he needs to get back to nature. They sense dimly that they are out of contact with reality, that something is wrong with their grasp of the world around them, but they accept an entirely fallacious interpretation of their problem. The truth is not that they are lost among abstractions, but that they have failed to discover the nature and proper use of abstractions. They are not lost among concepts, they are lost among cue words. They are cut off from reality not because they attempt to grasp it too intellectually, but because they attempt to grasp it only as seen by others. They attempt to grasp it second-hand. And they move through an unreal world of verbal rituals, mouthing the slogans and phrases they hear repeated by others, falsely imagining that those empty words are concepts, and never apprehending the proper use of their conceptual faculty, never learning what first-hand conceptual knowledge consists of. Then they are ready for the Zen Buddhist who tells them that the solution to their alienation from reality is to empty their mind of all thought and sit for an hour, cross-legged, contemplating the pattern of veins on a leaf. It is a well-known psychological fact that when men are neurotically anxious, when they suffer from feelings of dread for which they cannot account, they often attempt to make their plight more tolerable by directing their fear at some external object. They seek to persuade themselves that their fear is a rational response to the threat of germs, or the possible appearance of burglars, or the danger of lightning, or the brain-controlling radiations of Martians. The process by which men decide that the cause of their alienation is capitalism is not dissimilar. There are reasons, however, why capitalism is the target for their projection and rationalization. The alienated man is fleeing from the responsibility of a volitional, i.e. self-directing, consciousness, the freedom to think or not to think, to initiate a process of reason or to evade it, is a burden he longs to escape. But since this freedom is inherent in his nature as man, there is no escape from it. Hence his guilt and anxiety when he abandons reason and sight in favor of feelings and blindness. But there is another level on which man confronts the issue of freedom, the existential or social level, and here escape is possible. Political freedom is not a metaphysical given, it has to be achieved, hence it can be rejected. The psychological root of the revolt against freedom in one's existence is the revolt against freedom in one's consciousness. The root of the revolt against self-responsibility in action is the revolt against self-direction in thought. The man who does not want to think does not want to bear responsibility for the consequences of his actions, nor for his own life. It is appropriate in this connection to quote a passage from Who is Ayn Rand, in which I discuss the similarity of the attacks against capitalism launched by 19th-century medievalists and socialists. In the writings of both medievalists and socialists, one can observe the unmistakable longing for a society in which man's existence will be automatically guaranteed to him. That is, in which man will not have to bear responsibility for his own survival. Both camps project their ideal society as one characterized by that which they call harmony, by freedom from rapid change or challenge or the exacting demands of competition. A society in which each must do his prescribed part to contribute to the well-being of the whole, but in which no one will face the necessity of making choices and decisions that will crucially affect his life and future. In which the question of what one has or has not earned, and does or does not deserve, will not come up. In which rewards will not be tied to achievement, and in which someone's benevolence will guarantee that one need never bear the consequences of one's errors. The failure of capitalism to conform to what may be termed this pastoral view of existence is essential to the medievalists' and socialists' indictment of a free society. It is not a Garden of Eden that capitalism offers men. Today, of course, capitalism has largely been abandoned in favor of a mixed economy, i.e. a mixture of freedom and statism, moving steadily in the direction of increasing statism. Today we are far closer to the ideal society of the socialists than when Marx first wrote of the workers' alienation. Yet with every advance of collectivism, the cries concerning man's alienation grow louder. The problem, we are told, is getting worse. In communist countries, when such criticisms are allowed to be voiced, some commentators are beginning to complain that the Marxist solution to the workers' alienation has failed, that man under communism is still alienated, that the new harmony with nature and one's fellow men has not come. It didn't come to the medieval serf or guildsman either, the propaganda of commentators such as Erich Fromm notwithstanding. Man cannot escape from his nature, and if he establishes a social system which is inimical to the requirements of his nature, a system which forbids him to function as a rational, independent being, psychological and physical disaster is the result. A free society, of course, cannot automatically guarantee the mental well-being of all its members. Freedom is not a sufficient condition to assure man's proper fulfillment, but it is a necessary condition. And capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, is the only system which provides that condition. The problem of alienation is not metaphysical. It is not man's natural fate, never to be escaped, like some sort of original sin. It is a disease. It is not the consequence of capitalism or industrialism or bigness, and it cannot be legislated out of existence by the abolition of property rights. The problem of alienation is psycho-epistemological. It pertains to how man chooses to use his own consciousness. It is the product of man's revolt against thinking, which means against reality. If a man defaults on the responsibility of seeking knowledge, choosing values and setting goals, if this is the sphere he surrenders to the authority of others, how is he to escape the feeling that the universe is closed to him? It is, by his own choice. The proper answer to the question, "And how am I to face the odds of man's bedevilment and God's, I a stranger and afraid in a world I never made," is, "Why didn't you?" Chapter 24, Requiem for Man, by Ayn Rand, the last chapter. In advocating capitalism, I have said and stressed for years that capitalism is incompatible with altruism and mysticism. Those who chose to doubt that the issue is either-or have now heard it from the highest authority of the opposite side, Pope Paul VI. The encyclical Populorum Progressio, on the development of peoples, is an unusual document. It reads as if a long repressed emotion broke out into the open, past the barrier of carefully measured, cautiously calculated sentences, with the hissing pressure of centuries of silence. The sentences are full of contradictions. The emotion is consistent. The encyclical is the manifesto of an impassioned hatred for capitalism. But its evil is much more profound, and its target is more than mere politics. It is written in terms of a mystic altruist sense of life. A sense of life is the subconscious equivalent of metaphysics, a preconceptual, emotionally integrated appraisal of man's nature and of his relationship to existence. To a mystic altruist sense of life, words are mere approximations, hence the encyclical's tone of evasion. But what is eloquently revealing is the nature of that which is being evaded. On the question of capitalism, the encyclical's position is explicit and unequivocal. Referring to the Industrial Revolution, the encyclical declares, "But it is unfortunate that on these new conditions of society, a system has been constructed which considers profit as the key motive for economic progress, competition as the supreme law of economics, and private ownership of the means of production as an absolute right that has no limits and carries no corresponding social obligation. But if it is true that a type of capitalism has been the source of excessive suffering, injustices, and fratricidal conflicts whose effects still persist, it would also be wrong to attribute to industrialization itself evils that belong to the woeful system which accompanied it." Paragraph 26. The Vatican is not the city room of a third-rate Marxist tabloid. It is an institution geared to a perspective of centuries, to scholarship and timeless philosophical deliberation. Ignorance, therefore, cannot be the explanation of the above. Even the leftists know that the advent of capitalism and industrialization was not an unfortunate coincidence, and that the first made the second possible. What are the excessive suffering, injustices, and fratricidal conflicts caused by capitalism? The encyclical gives no answer. What social system, past or present, has a better record in respect to any social evil that anyone might choose to ascribe to capitalism? Has the feudalism of the Middle Ages? Has absolute monarchy? Has socialism or fascism? No answer. If one is to consider excessive suffering, injustices, and fratricidal conflicts, what aspect of capitalism can be placed in the same category with the terror and wholesale slaughter of Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia? No answer. If there is no causal connection between capitalism and the people's progress, welfare, and standard of living, why are these highest in the countries whose systems have the largest element of capitalistic economic freedom? No answer. Since the encyclical is concerned with history and with fundamental political principles, yet does not discuss or condemn any social system other than capitalism, one must conclude that all other systems are compatible with the encyclical's political philosophy. This is supported by the fact that capitalism is condemned not for some lesser characteristics, but for its essentials, which are not the base of any other system: the profit motive, competition, and private ownership of the means of production. By what moral standard does the encyclical judge a social system? Its most specific accusation, directed at capitalism, reads as follows: "The desire for necessities is legitimate, and work undertaken to obtain them is a duty. If any man will not work, neither let him eat. But the acquiring of temporal goods can lead to greed, to the insatiable desire for more, and can make increased power a tempting objective. Individuals, families, and nations can be overcome by avarice, be they poor or rich, and all can fall victim to a stifling materialism." Paragraph 18. Since time immemorial and pre-industrial, greed has been the accusation hurled at the rich by the concrete-bound illiterates who were unable to conceive of the source of wealth or of the motivation of those who produce it. But the above was not written by an illiterate. Terms such as greed and avarice connote the caricature image of two individuals, one fat, the other lean, one indulging in mindless gluttony, the other starving over chests of hoarded gold, both symbols of the acquisition of riches for the sake of riches. Is that the motive power of capitalism? If all the wealth spent on personal consumption by all the rich of the United States were expropriated and distributed among our population, it would amount to less than a dollar per person. Try to figure out the amount if distributed to the entire population of the globe. The rest of American wealth is invested in production, and it is this constantly growing investment that raises America's standard of living by raising the productivity of its labor. This is primer economics, which Pope Paul VI cannot fail to know. To observe the technique of epistemological manipulation, read that quoted paragraph again and look past the images invoked by the window dressing of greed and avarice. You will observe that the evil being denounced is the insatiable desire for more. Of what? Of increased power. What sort of power? No direct answer is given in that paragraph. But the entire encyclical provides the answer by means of a significant omission. No distinction is drawn between economic power and political power, between production and force. They are used interchangeably in some passages and equated explicitly in others. If you look at the facts of reality, you will observe that the increased power which men of wealth seek under capitalism is the power of independent production, the power of an insatiable ambition to expand their productive capacity, and that this is what the encyclical damns. The evil is not work, but ambitious work. These implications are supported and gently stressed in a subsequent paragraph, which lists the encyclical's view of less human conditions of social existence. The lack of material necessities for those who are without the minimum essential for life, the moral deficiencies of those who are mutilated by selfishness, oppressive social structures, whether due to the abuses of ownership or to the abuses of power, and, as more human conditions, the passage from misery toward the possession of necessities. Paragraph 21. What necessities are the minimum essential for life? For what kind of life? Is it for mere physical survival? If so, for how long a survival? No answer is given. But the encyclical's principle is clear. Only those who rise no higher than the barest minimum of subsistence have the right to material possessions, and this right supersedes all the rights of all other men, including their right to life. This is stated explicitly. The Bible, from the first page on, teaches us that the whole of creation is for man, that it is his responsibility to develop it by intelligent effort and by means of his labor to perfect it, so to speak, for his use. If the world is made to furnish each individual with the means of livelihood and the instruments for his growth and progress, each man has therefore the right to find in the world what is necessary for himself. The recent council reminded us of this. God intended the earth and all that it contains for the use of every human being and people. Thus, as all men follow justice and charity, created goods should abound for them on a reasonable basis. All other rights whatsoever, including those of property and of free commerce, are to be subordinated to this principle. 22. Observe what element is missing from this view of the world, what human faculty is regarded as inessential or non-existent. I shall discuss this aspect later in more detail. For the moment, I shall merely call your attention to the use of the word man in the above paragraph. Which man? And to the term created goods. Created by whom? Blank out. That missing element becomes blatant in the encyclical's next paragraph. It is well known how strong were the words used by the fathers of the church to describe the proper attitude of persons who possess anything toward persons in need. To quote St. Ambrose, "You are not making a gift of your possessions to the poor person. You are handing over to him what is his. For what has been given in common for the use of all, you have arrogated to yourself. The world is given to all and not only to the rich." That is, private property does not constitute for anyone an absolute and unconditional right. No one is justified in keeping for his exclusive use what he does not need when others lack necessities. 23. St. Ambrose lived in the 4th century, when such views of property could conceivably have been explicable, if not justifiable. From the 19th century on, they can be neither. What solution does the encyclical offer to the problems of today's world? Individual initiative alone and the mere free play of competition could never assure successful development. One must avoid the risk of increasing still more the wealth of the rich and the dominion of the strong, while leaving the poor in their misery and adding to the servitude of the oppressed. Hence, programs are necessary in order to encourage, stimulate, coordinate, supplement, and integrate the activity of individuals and of intermediary bodies. It pertains to the public authorities to choose, even to lay down, the objectives to be pursued, the ends to be achieved, and the means for attaining these, and it is for them to stimulate all the forces engaged in this common activity. 33. A society in which the government, the public authorities, chooses and lays down the objectives to be pursued, the ends to be achieved, and the means for achieving them is a totalitarian state. It is therefore morally shocking to read the very next sentence. But let them take care to associate private initiative and intermediary bodies with this work. They will thus avoid the danger of complete collectivization or of arbitrary planning, which by denying liberty would prevent the exercise of the fundamental rights of the human person. 33. What are the fundamental rights of the human person, which are never defined in the encyclical, in a state where all other rights whatsoever are to be subordinated to this principle, the right to minimum sustenance? 22. What is liberty or private initiative in a state where the government lays down the ends and commandeers the means? What is incomplete collectivization? It is difficult to believe that modern compromisers, to whom that paragraph is addressed, could stretch their capacity for evasion far enough to take it to mean the advocacy of a mixed economy. A mixed economy is a mixture of capitalism and statism. When the principles and practices of capitalism are damned and annihilated at the root, what is to prevent the statist collectivization from becoming complete? The moral shock comes from the realization that the encyclical regards some men's capacity for evasion as infinitely elastic. Judging by the reactions it received, the encyclical did not miscalculate. I have always maintained that every political theory is based on some code of ethics. Here again, the encyclical confirms my statement, though from the viewpoint of a moral code which is the opposite of mine. The same duty of solidarity that rests on individuals exists also for nations. Advanced nations have a very heavy obligation to help the developing peoples. It is necessary to put this teaching of the Council into effect. Although it is normal that a nation should be the first to benefit from the gifts that Providence has bestowed on it as the fruit of the labors of its people, still no country can claim on that account to keep its wealth for itself alone. 48. This seems clear enough, but the encyclical takes pains not to be misunderstood. In other words, the rule of free trade, taken by itself, is no longer able to govern international relations. One must recognize that it is the fundamental principle of liberalism, as the rule for commercial exchange, which is questioned here. 58. We must repeat once more that the superfluous wealth of rich countries should be placed at the service of poor nations. The rule which up to now held good for the benefit of those nearest to us must today be applied to all the needy of this world. 49. If need, global need, is the criterion of morality, if minimum subsistence, the standard of living of the least developed savages, is the criterion of property rights, then every new shirt or dress, every ice cream cone, every automobile, refrigerator, or television set becomes superfluous wealth. Remember that rich is a relative concept, and that the sharecroppers of the United States are fabulously rich compared to the laborers of Asia or Africa. Yet the encyclical denounces as unjust free trade among unequally developed countries, on the grounds that highly industrialized nations export, for the most part, manufactured goods, while countries with less developed economies have only food, fibers, and other raw materials to sell. 57. Alleging that this perpetuates the poverty of the undeveloped countries, the encyclical demands that international trade be ruled not by the laws of the free market, but by the need of its neediest participants. How this would work in practice is made explicitly clear. This demands great generosity, much sacrifice, and unceasing effort on the part of the rich man. Let each one examine his conscience, a conscience that conveys a new message for our times. Is he ready to pay higher taxes so that the public authorities can intensify their efforts in favor of development? Is he ready to pay a higher price for imported goods so that the producer may be more justly rewarded? 47. It is not only the rich who pay taxes. The major share of the tax burden in the United States is carried by the middle and lower income classes. It is not for the exclusive personal consumption of the rich that foreign goods or raw materials are imported. The price of food is not a major concern to the rich, it is a crucial concern to the poor. And since food is listed as one of the chief products of the undeveloped countries, project what the encyclical's proposal would mean. It would mean that an American housewife would have to buy food produced by men who scratch the soil with bare hands or hand plows, and would pay prices which, if paid to America's mechanized farmers, would have given her 100 or 1,000 times more. Which items of her family budget would she have to sacrifice so that those undeveloped producers may be more justly rewarded? Would she sacrifice some purchases of clothing? But her clothing budget would have shrunk in the same manner and proportion, since she would have to provide the just rewards of the producers of fibers and other raw materials, and so on. What then would happen to her standard of living? And what would happen to the American farmers and producers of raw materials? Forced to compete, not in terms of productive competence, but of need, they would have to arrest their development and revert to the methods of the hand plow. What then would happen to the standard of living of the whole world? No, it is not possible that Pope Paul VI was so ignorant of economics and so lacking in the capacity to concretize his theories that he offered such proposals in the name of humanism without realizing the unspeakably inhuman cruelty they entail. It seems inexplicable, but there is a certain basic premise that would explain it. It would integrate the encyclical's clashing elements, the contradictions, the equivocations, the omissions, the unanswered questions, into a consistent pattern. To discover it, one must ask, what is the encyclical's view of man's nature? That particular view is seldom admitted or fully identified by those who hold it. It is less a matter of conscious philosophy than of a feeling dictated by a sense of life. The conscious philosophy of those who hold it consists predominantly of attempts to rationalize it. To identify that view, let us go to its roots, to the kind of phenomena which give rise to it in sense of life terms. I will ask you to project the look on a child's face when he grasps the answer to some problem he has been striving to understand. It is a radiant look of joy, of liberation, almost of triumph, which is unself-conscious, yet self-assertive, and its radiance seems to spread in two directions, outward as an illumination of the world, inward as the first spark of what is to become the fire of an earned pride. If you have seen this look or experienced it, you know that if there is such a concept as sacred, meaning the best, the highest possible to man, this look is the sacred. The not to be betrayed, the not to be sacrificed for anything or anyone. This look is not confined to children. Comic strip artists are in the habit of representing it by means of a light bulb flashing on above the head of a character who has suddenly grasped an idea. In simple, primitive terms, this is an appropriate symbol. An idea is a light turned on in a man's soul. It is the steady, confident reflection of that light that you look for in the faces of adults, particularly of those to whom you entrust your most precious values. You look for it in the eyes of a surgeon performing an operation on the body of a loved one. You look for it in the face of a pilot at the controls of the plane in which you are flying. And if you are consistent, you look for it in the person of the man or woman you marry. That light bulb look is the flash of a human intelligence in action. It is the outward manifestation of man's rational faculty. It is the signal and symbol of man's mind. and to the extent of your humanity, it is involved in everything you seek, enjoy, value, or love. But suppose that admiration is not your response to that look on the face of a child or adult. Suppose that your response is a nameless fear. Then you will spend your life and your philosophical capacity on the struggle never to let that fear be named. You will find rationalizations to hide it, and you will call that child's look a look of selfishness or arrogance or intransigence or pride, all of which will be true, but not in the way you will struggle to suggest. You will feel that that look in man's eyes is your greatest, most dangerous enemy, and the desire to vanquish that look will become your only absolute, taking precedence over reason, logic, consistency, existence, reality. The desire to vanquish that look is the desire to break man's spirit. Thus you will acquire the kind of sense of life that produced the encyclical Populorum Progressio. It was not produced by the sense of life of any one person, but by the sense of life of an institution. The dominant chord of the encyclical sense of life is hatred for man's mind, hence hatred for man, hence hatred for life and for this earth, hence hatred for man's enjoyment of his life on earth, and hence, as a last and least consequence, hatred for the only social system that makes all these values possible in practice, capitalism. I could maintain this on the grounds of a single example. Consider the proposal to condemn Americans to a lifetime of unrewarded drudgery at forced labor, making them work as hard as they do, or harder, with nothing to gain but the barest subsistence, while savages collect the products of their effort. When you hear a proposal of this sort, what image leaps into your mind? What I see is the young people who start out in life with self-confident eagerness, who work their way through school, their eyes fixed on their future with a joyous, uncomplaining dedication. And what meaning a new coat, a new rug, an old car bought second-hand, or a ticket to the movies has in their lives as the fuel of their courage? Anyone who evades that image while he plans to dispose of the fruit of the labors of people and declares that human effort is not a sufficient reason for a man to keep his own product may claim any motive but love of humanity. I could rest my case on this alone, but I shan't. The encyclical offers more than a sense of life. It contains specific, conscious, philosophical corroboration. Observe that it is not aimed at destroying man's mind, but at a slower, more agonizing equivalent, at enslaving it. The key to understanding the encyclical social theories is contained in a statement of John Galt. "I am the man whose existence your blank outs were intended to permit you to ignore. I am the man whom you did not want either to live or to die. You did not want me to live because you were afraid of knowing that I carried the responsibility you dropped and that your lives depended upon me. You did not want me to die because you knew it." Atlas shrugged. The encyclical neither denies nor acknowledges the existence of human intelligence. It merely treats it as an inconsequential human attribute, requiring no consideration. The main and virtually only reference to the role of intelligence in man's existence reads as follows: "The introduction of industry is a necessity for economic growth and human progress. It is also a sign of development and contributes to it. By persistent work and use of his intelligence, man gradually wrests nature's secrets from her and finds a better application for her riches. As his self-mastery increases, he develops a taste for research and discovery, an ability to take a calculated risk, boldness in enterprises, generosity in what he does, and a sense of responsibility." 25. Observe that the creative power of man's mind, of his basic means of survival, of the faculty that distinguishes him from animals, is described as an acquired taste, like a taste for olives or for ladies' fashions. Observe that even this paltry acknowledgement is not allowed to stand by itself, lest research and discovery be taken as a value, they are enmeshed in such irrelevancies as generosity. The same pattern is repeated in discussing the subject of work. The encyclical warns that it, work, can sometimes be given exaggerated significance, but admits that work is a creative process, then adds that When work is done in common, when hope, hardship, ambition, and joy are shared, men find themselves to be brothers, 27. And then, work, of course, can have contrary effects, for it promises money, pleasure, and power, invites some to selfishness, others to revolt, 28. This means that pleasure, the kind of pleasure which is earned by productive work, is evil. Power, economic power, the kind earned by productive work, is evil. And money, the thing which the entire encyclical begs for passionately, is evil if kept in the hands of those who earned it. Do you see John Galt doing work in common, sharing hope, hardship, ambition, and joy with James Taggart, Wesley Mouch, and Dr. Floyd Ferris? But these are only fiction characters, you say. Okay. Do you see Pasteur? Do you see Columbus? Do you see Galileo? And what happened to him when he tried to share his hope, hardship, ambition, and joy with the Catholic Church? No. The encyclical does not deny the existence of men of genius. If it did, it would not have to plead so hard for global sharing. If all men were interchangeable, if degrees of ability were of no consequence, everyone would produce the same amount, and there would be no benefits for anyone to derive from sharing. The encyclical assumes that the unnamed, unrecognized, unacknowledged fountainheads of wealth would somehow continue to function, and proceeds to set up conditions of existence which would make their functioning impossible. Remember that intelligence is not an exclusive monopoly of genius. It is an attribute of all men, and the differences are only a matter of degree. If conditions of existence are destructive to genius, they are destructive to every man, each in proportion to his intelligence. If genius is penalized, so is the faculty of intelligence in every other man. There is only this difference. The average man does not possess the genius's power of self-confident resistance, and will break much faster. He will give up his mind in hopeless bewilderment under the first touch of pressure. There is no place for the mind in the world proposed by the encyclical, and no place for man. The entities populating it are insentient robots geared to perform prescribed tasks in a gigantic tribal machine, robots deprived of choice, judgment, values, convictions, and self-esteem, above all self-esteem. You are not making a gift of your possessions to the poor person. You are handing over to him what is his. 23. Does the wealth created by Thomas A. Edison belong to the bushman who did not create it? Does the paycheck you earned this week belong to the hippies next door who did not earn it? A man would not accept that notion. A robot would. A man would take pride in his achievement. It is the pride of achievement that has to be burned out of the robots of the future. For what has been given in common for the use of all, you have arrogated to yourself. 23. God intended the earth and all that it contains for the use of every human being and people. 22. You are one of the things that the earth contains. Are you, therefore, intended for the use of every human being and people? The encyclical's answer is apparently yes, since the world it proposes is based on that premise in every essential respect. A man would not accept that premise. A man such as John Galt would say, "You have never discovered the industrial age, and you cling to the morality of the barbarian eras when a miserable form of human subsistence was produced by the muscular labor of slaves." Every mystic had always longed for slaves, to protect him from the material reality he dreaded. But you, you grotesque little atavists, stare blindly at the skyscrapers and smokestacks around you and dream of enslaving the material providers who are scientists, inventors, industrialists. When you clamor for public ownership of the means of production, you are clamoring for public ownership of the mind. Atlas shrugged. But a robot would not say it. A robot would be programmed not to question the source of wealth and would never discover that the source of wealth is man's mind. On hearing such notions as, "The whole of creation is for man," 22, and "The world is given to all," 23, a man would grasp that these are equivocations which evade the question of what is necessary to make use of natural resources. He would know that nothing is given to him, that the transformation of raw materials into human goods requires a process of thought and labor which some men will perform and others will not, and that in justice no man can have a primary right to the goods created by the thought and labor of others. A robot would not protest. It would see no difference between itself and raw materials. It would take its own motions as the given. A man who loves his work and knows what enormous virtue, what discipline of thought, of energy, of purpose, of devotion it requires, would rebel at the prospect of letting it serve those who scorn it. And scorn for material production is splattered all over the encyclical. Less well-off peoples can never be sufficiently on their guard against this temptation which comes to them from wealthy nations. This temptation is a way of acting that is principally aimed at the conquest of material prosperity. 41. Advocating a dialogue between different civilizations for the purpose of founding world solidarity, the encyclical stresses that it must be a dialogue based on man, not on commodities or technical skills. 73. Which means that technical skills are a negligible characteristic, that no virtue was needed to acquire them, that the ability to produce commodities deserves no acknowledgement and is not part of the concept man. Thus, while the entire encyclical is a plea for the products of industrial wealth, it is scornfully indifferent to their source. It asserts a right to the effects but ignores the cause. It purports to speak on a lofty moral plane but leaves the process of material production outside the realm of morality, as if that process were an activity of a low order that neither involved nor required any moral principles. I quote from Atlas Shrugged. An industrialist, blank out, there is no such person. A factory is a natural resource like a tree, a rock, or a mud puddle. Who solved the problem of production? Humanity, they answer. What was the solution? The goods are here. How did they get here? Somehow. What caused it? Nothing has causes. The last sentence is inapplicable. The encyclical's answer would be providence. The process of production is directed by man's mind. Man's mind is not an indeterminate faculty. It requires certain conditions in order to function, and the cardinal one among them is freedom. The encyclical is singularly, eloquently devoid of any consideration of the mind's requirements, as if it expected human thought to keep on gushing forth anywhere, under any conditions, from under any pressures, or as if it intended that gusher to stop. If concern for human poverty and suffering were one's primary motive, one would seek to discover their cause. One would not fail to ask, why did some nations develop while others did not? Why have some nations achieved material abundance while others have remained stagnant in subhuman misery? History, and specifically the unprecedented prosperity explosion of the 19th century, would give an immediate answer. Capitalism is the only system that enables men to produce abundance, and the key to capitalism is individual freedom. It is obvious that a political system affects a society's economics by protecting or impeding men's productive activities. But this is what the encyclical will neither admit nor permit. The relationship of politics and economics is the thing it most emphatically ignores or evades and denies. It declares that no such relationship exists. In projecting its world of the future, where the civilized countries are to assume the burden of helping and developing the uncivilized ones, the encyclical states, and the receiving countries could demand that there be no interference in their political life or subversion of their social structures. As sovereign states, they have the right to conduct their own affairs, to decide on their policies, and to move freely toward the kind of society they choose. 54. What if the kind of society they choose makes production, development, and progress impossible? What if it practices communism like Soviet Russia, or exterminates minorities like Nazi Germany, or establishes a religious caste system like India, or clings to a nomadic, anti-industrial form of existence like the Arab countries, or simply consists of tribal gangs ruled by brute force like some of the new countries in Africa? The encyclical's tacit answer is that these are the prerogatives of sovereign states, that we must respect different cultures, and that the civilized nations of the world must make up for these deficits, somehow. Some of the answer is not tacit. Given the increasing needs of the underdeveloped countries, It should be considered quite normal for an advanced country to devote a part of its production to meet their needs and to train teachers, engineers, technicians, and scholars prepared to put their knowledge and their skill at the disposal of less fortunate peoples. 48. The encyclical gives severely explicit instructions to such emissaries. They ought not to conduct themselves in a lordly fashion, but as helpers and co-workers. A people quickly perceives whether those who come to help them do so with or without affection. Their message is in danger of being rejected if it is not presented in the context of brotherly love. 71. They should be free of all nationalistic pride. They should realize that their competence does not confer on them a superiority in every field. They should realize that theirs is not the only civilization, nor does it enjoy a monopoly of valuable elements. They should be intent on discovering, along with its history, the component elements of the cultural riches of the country receiving them. Mutual understanding will be established which will enrich both cultures. 72. This is said to civilized men who are to venture into countries where sacred cows are fed while children are left to starve, where female infants are killed or abandoned by the roadside, where men go blind, medical help being forbidden by their religion, where women are mutilated to ensure their fidelity, where unspeakable tortures are ceremonially inflicted on prisoners, where cannibalism is practiced. Are these the cultural riches which a Western man is to greet with brotherly love? Are these the valuable elements which he is to admire and adopt? Are these the fields in which he is not to regard himself as superior? And when he discovers entire populations rotting alive in such conditions, is he not to acknowledge with a burning stab of pride and gratitude, the achievements of his nation and his culture, of the men who created them and left him a nobler heritage to carry forward? The encyclical's implicit answer is no. He is not to judge, not to question, not to